Okay, so the Book of Kings, or Sefer Melachim, just a little bit, I want to talk maybe 10, perhaps 15 minutes about just the book as a whole before we get into the specific issues of, the actual material, the content. First of all, it's always important to talk about authorship, that is, who wrote the book. It's an important first question. That is, if you have a book, it's good to know written by who. So the Gemara Baba Batra sort of says very simply and straightforward that Yirmiyahu, the Navi, wrote his own book, that is, the book of Yirmiyahu, wrote Kinot, which is Eicha, and wrote Sefer Melachim. The question is, what exactly does that mean? Because Yirmiyahu lived at the end of the Melachim period. The Melachim period that we're going to discuss starts at about 1000 before the Common Era, probably about 980 before the Common Era. That is, considering the destruction of the temple at 586, I'm not so good especially subtracting backwards, but it's about, 500 years. About 500 years. About a half a millennium. So Yirmiyahu lived about 450 years after the events took place. The question is, how can you say that Yirmiyahu wrote the book? So what's important to understand is that when it says that Yirmiyahu wrote the book, that's a question of redaction, not authorship. That is, Yirmiyahu did not have a prophecy that Shlomo went to this guy and said this, and that Achiyah Shiloni, who we're going to meet, said this. What's going on is that there's a series of authors that are putting together prophetic material on an ongoing basis. When Chazal say that Yirmiyahu wrote the book, what they mean is he put it together, he redacted the book. I have no doubt that quite a bit of the stuff at the end during the actual fall of the temple was actually written by Yirmiyahu. There's much stuff, in fact, In fact, there are many things from Yirmiyahu, Sefer Yirmiyahu, in fact, when you get to chapter 40, after the prophecies, actually continues the history of the book. The whole story of Gedaliah is mentioned in one verse in Sefer Melachim. The real story of Gedaliah, let me tell you, it's a tragedy beyond that which is described in Sefer Melachim, is not described until Yirmiyahu. So you can really feel that Yirmiyahu physically authored the end of the book of Melachim. But you cannot say that, it's not reasonable to say that for the beginning of the book, for the first 350 years until Yirmiyahu came on the scene. That is, what we're not dealing here with Mosaic prophecy, where God says, I want you to write the following words, and it was in the day that David got old, and etc., etc., which is how the book starts off. There's no, God is not telling Yirmiyahu word by word to write that down. He's not Moses. That's not his game. In fact, I'm almost tempted to say a very dangerous and dirty word. I hope you'll forgive me. I'll say it in a sotto voice. No, that's okay. It's not that dirty. Although in the Bible business, it is dirty, so everybody please don't get too offended. Documents. Now, in the Torah world, that's something that we religious Jews reject out of hand. God wrote the Torah, end of story, dictated it to Moshe. There's a little bit of Moshe in the book, certainly, and certainly some of the stories are you could see that they're word of mouth, and I'm going to explain what I mean by that in the Torah. But that's by and large a dirty word when it comes to the Torah. We simply reject that out of hand, and there's good reason to reject it out of hand. Kasuto proved that the document theory was by and large garbage. Wellhausen and his ilk were by and large rejected. Many of their questions still survive, but their answers are by and large rejected by scholarship. Although, again, depends where you go. Even by modern scholarship, because Wellhausen's goal was to rewrite the history of Israel, saying that at first Israel was this tribal state and then eventually evolved into monotheism much later. So that the dating of it has been rejected altogether. Everybody by and large agrees now that even if you're a scholar who's not firm and you believe in the documents, you believe that they're all honest witnesses of very ancient past. What Wellhausen thought is that certain books were written even after the exilic times, after the fall of the temple, because he wanted to reshape the Judaism in his own image, to be honest, because he was a Protestant, and he wanted things to, you know, go Protestant. He wanted to sort of downgrade the Judaism of Israel. So monotheism wasn't an option for him, so there's no way any of the books of Moses could be written as far back as they were. Modern scholarship projects that. I mean, we have an Egyptian king named Nechnaton, Akhenaten, or Amenhotep IV, who worshipped the sun disk, a primitive form of monotheism. So the idea that monotheism exists in ancient times is well stated. But the full idea of documents, of course, from people reject altogether. God wrote it, and while he had different moods while he wrote it, he wrote it b'shem. No, that's it. Even Chazal say that b'shem Hashem. Yudke Vavke was when he had Rachmanos. It was Midat Arachman. Elohim was Midat Hadin. Even Chazal say that he had different moods when he was putting together different agendas, and therefore a different style with the agenda. And Kasuto does a beautiful job. He actually takes Dante and shows that part of Dante's work, the Great Inferno, part of it is written in one style and part of it is written in another style. But if I go into that, I'm going to definitely digress too much. I'm sorry, my computer is a little bit... It's almost time to buy a new computer and the screen goes out. Got my notes back. Okay. So, that's right. It's really bad. I got little gerbils running inside. So, but documents, however, when it comes to Nevi'im, is not a dirty word. That is, nobody suspects that Yirmiyahu wrote the whole book, and I'll prove it to you in a second. But by and large, people think that there were three sets of documents. There were documents that Nevi'im wrote, because Nevi'im had a school of Nevi'im and Nevu'im. They wrote during that period of time, and they passed it down to their kids, and their kids passed it down to their kids, and Yirmiyahu collected them and put together documents. There's even a story like this where Yirmiyahu tells his servant, Baruch Ben Neriah, go get this document, write it again. There's this idea that information is passed down generation to generation. There's also chronicle source. Now, when I say chronicles, I don't mean the book of chronicles are Divrei Hayamim. That was written by Ezra. But I'm talking about a list of chronicles. All kings had the years that they were born and who they were married to. What Yirmiyahu was told to do was write a book about kingship and why it succeeds, why it fails. It's up to Yirmiyahu to decide how to best write that book. So the idea that Yirmiyahu would go to a document, and here, again, I know it's a dirty word, but I mean it in the best senses, he would open up a book that says, you know, King whatever ruled for 27 years and his wife's name was Hephzibah, in the case of... then that was probably something that Yirmiyahu didn't have to memorize. Nobody had to give him God didn't have to say, his wife's name was Hephzibah. It was there. It was in the page. The fact that he included it or did not include it is interesting. That goes to what he believed his mission was in delivering the message that God wanted him to give by putting together the book. But he was certainly not limited to using secular stuff. There are two proofs that I'd like to bring to this, and I'd really like to leave it alone. Well, there are three issues to talk about. First of all, in the book of Bamidbar, there's a war of Sichon, the Amorites, against the Moabites and how they stole the Moabites' land. Now, it was very important because the Jews rolled through that land, and land that was once the Moabites was lost to the Amorites, and then God said, you can't touch the Moabites because they're your brothers. I gave them that land. But since they lost the land already to Sichon, who was a Canaanite, you can take that land away. And the Torah, if you're familiar with it, mentions a song, Vahev Basufa. It's the song that's sung by the original, the singing group, before Israel really existed, before Israel was on the spot. And they sung this beautiful song about how Moab lost their land to Canaan. This is only Kodesh because it's included in our Sefer. It wasn't written originally by Jews. Now, you could argue that Moshe took that original song and perhaps rewrote it. But I don't think it's necessary to do that. That is, if there's a song that supports what... If God said, I want you to take this top 10 song, I don't know, whatever, Sound of Silence. I like that Sound of Silence. It makes my prophetic point. And I want you to include the Sound of Silence into the Torah, then it's Kodesh, even though the original document of which was not necessarily Kodesh. That is, it's transformed into Kedusha. Certainly that song, Vahev Basufim, about Sichon, Eish Yatzami Sichon, the Le'avami, me Kiryat Amon, I think, That wasn't written by Jews. Nobody said it was. In fact, it specifically says, Kacha Amru HaMoshalim. That's what these people from Mashal used to say. And now I'd like to talk about Mashal, little parables, because that's another proof to this whole issue. Chazal say that Yirmiyahu wrote the book. But Chazal say Mishlei was written by... Chazal was written by anybody? Mishlei written by? Was not written by Shlomo Melech. I'll read you what Chazal say. Was written by Chizkiyahu. So it says, Baba Batra, I'll read it to you specifically, Chizkiyahu v'siyato, Chizkiyahu and his friends, Katvu Yishayahu, Sefer Yishayahu.
But I thought that was conventional wisdom that yes, he wrote it.
No, Shlomo, no. It's not conventional wisdom. That's what people think, I think, because it starts off with Mashal the Shlomo, but I'll show you something interesting in the Sefer. That's the beginning of the Sefer. I'll show you the end of the Sefer, something interesting. I can just tell you what Chazal said in Baba Basra. I'll read it if you want to. You can certainly pull it down. Don't believe a word I say. By all means, always check my sources. I make mistakes all the time. But I actually copied it here because I was afraid you would doubt me. Chizkiyahu v'siyato katvu Yishayahu. They wrote the book of Yishayahu. That means Yishayahu did not write his book. Now again, keep in mind that word right. I'm transforming that word right a little bit. Let me tell you what else they wrote. Mishlei, Shir HaShirim, the Kohelet. those four books, which are, ask anybody, you know, on the street, who wrote them? Shlomo wrote them. It says so. So now if you have a Tanakh, I'd like you to open chapter 25 of Mishlei. See, the problem is that all the good information is always at the back of the book, and nobody ever gets to the back of the book. So that's the shame of it. But if we open up to Sefer Mishlei, which is right after Tehillim and right before Eov, one of the three big ketuvim, chapter 25, right after Tehillim is usually the first book of ketuvim, of the writings. And then I have one more Tanakh here for anybody who wants. So chapter 25 says something amazing. So everybody, I'll give everybody a little more time to flip because it's fun to see it on your own. Chapter 25 of Mishlei, of Proverbs. Nice, right? It's a surprise. Gam Eila Mishlei Shlomo. These are also the parables of Shlomo. I'm sorry, it's a hard... If you're not familiar how to use that Tanakh, it takes a while to get used to. It's a beautiful Tanakh, but it takes a while. I'll read it out loud to you. It's a short passage, but I want you to get the surprise of seeing it yourself. Gam Eila Mishlei Shlomo. These are also the proverbs of Shlomo, Asher Het Tiku Anshei Chizkiyahu Melech Yudah, which were copied by the people of Chizkiyahu, the king of Judah. What that means was that there were... And Chizkiyahu was trying to make a point. By the way, you think I wrote this stuff? It wasn't me. It was Shlomo. What Chazal mean when they say it was written by Chizkiyahu doesn't mean that the Mishalim were actually written by Chizkiyahu, although it's certainly possible some of them were. I mean, he was the editor of the book. He was the redactor. You have to translate redaction that way, and that's evident from the pasuk. He's not the only one. There's somebody else, by the way, here at the end of the book, if I'm not mistaken. Oh, look in pasuk Lamed. Pasuk Lamed, we're not sure what to make out of it. In Mishlei chapter 30, I'll read it to you. Divrei Agur ben Yakeh. The words of Agur, the son of Yakeh, Hamasa. Num Hagever, Le'itiel, Le'itiel, Ve'uchal. We don't know who this is. I think according to some, it's probably Shlomo, but there seems to be another person involved in the writing of Mishlei. Take a look at Lamed Aleph, just in case I'm not translating that correct. Lamed Aleph is more obvious. Divrei Limuel Melech, the words of Limuel the king, Masa Asher Yisartahu Imo, and then he does the famous Esha Chayil, which means Esha Chayil isn't even Shlomo's, unless Limuel is Shlomo, which is possible. But we have no reference for that.
I don't remember Limuel being mentioned at all.
As far as we don't know who Limuel is. It must be another name for one of our kings, Limuel, I guess, for who is to whom is God. It could be Shlomo, but it could be Chizkiyahu, it could be somebody else. Yeah.
In what's called in Pasuk Dalet, I make reference to what it's okay for a king to do and what not to do. Wouldn't it be a little out of line for somebody who's not of the status of a king to make that kind of a reference?
I agree with you, but Chizkiyahu is a king.
Okay.
Yeah, that is, and it may be this was written by Shlomo, by the way, but the book was without question redacted, edited by Chizkiyahu, and maybe Lemuel, if he's a unique guy, we don't know who he is. But one of the kings, could be Chizkiyahu, could be Shlomo, but it could be somebody else, certainly. And this other person also, we just don't, Yagur ben Yaka, I don't know who that is. So anyway, so that essentially, I want to establish that point about Malachim. I already took 15 minutes at, so I better move on quickly, but I think that establishes pretty well the idea of redaction versus authorship. Redaction versus authorship. And there's no reason to assume that there's prophecy, there's Mosaic prophecy, which is essentially dictation from God, and then there's everybody else, and this is well attested to by in the Guide to the Perplexed. All other prophets were at a much, much lower level than Moshe. They saw things in dreams, they got missions, they got messages, but how they wanted to put their book to make the message was by and large up to the individual prophet. Now I'd like to go on, and I'd like to just talk one more thing about the purpose of the book, which is why it's different than... the Book of Kings starts with... let's read the first few lines, actually, and this way we could say we actually got into the book.
Could I ask a question?
By all means, of course.
I think I got lost somewhere. So, when I came in, you were saying that Yirmiyahu did not write Malachim?
He wrote it, if you translate right, as redacted, edited, and certainly wrote the end parts that he was alive for. But the beginning, he inherited from multiple sources. He invented them from other prophets, but he probably had books and other things which he could use to serve his purpose. So that's certainly my opinion, and I think that's probably the best way to to approach these things. Well, by the way, the question is, I forgot to bring you the ultimate proof. The question is, who then wrote the beginning parts? So it should be pretty obvious who wrote the beginning parts, except Malachim never tells us. But Divrei HaYamim does. So if I read you Divrei HaYamim, I'll read you the following. I won't open it to it right now, but it's in chapter 29 of Divrei HaYamim Aleph, Chronicles 1. Hinam, the words of David, the life of David, Ketuvim al Divrei Shmuel HaRoeh, that written in the words of Shmuel the prophet, Val Divrei Natan HaNavi, and also in the books of Natan, Val Divrei Gad HaChozeh. And that shouldn't surprise anybody. There were two other active, there were actually five active prophets. The other three, Asaf, Heman, Yedutun, we'll meet at a later time. But Natan and God are in play, and they're certainly writing books. They're certainly prophets of the status of, I don't know if they're quite Shmuel, but they're certainly no, they're no pushovers. And it's probably they're who are writing. They've probably taken over the school of Shmuel, and they're the ones who are active at the time. We'll meet other prophets as we go along, both here and others, Hintzu and Chronicles. But if you ask me who actually wrote these chapters, I would say certainly Natan. Certainly Natan. It certainly seems to be his perspective, and we'll see that as we read it. But anyway, let's read the first few verses. Vamelech David Zaken, he was old, Bab Yamim, very old, close to his, the end of his days. Vayechasuhu Bab Gadim, and they covered up with clothes, Velo Yichamlo, he couldn't get warm. Vayomru Lo Avadav Yivakshula Adini Amelech Narab Tula, so his servants say, let's find him a nice young girl. I don't want to translate Tula as virgin, because it's not always true, but that certainly is the implication here. Va'amdal Lefnei Amelech, and she'll do three things. She'll stand before the king, Vatilo Sochenet, she'll be to him, according to Rashi, as a warmer, although it's hard to say, it's a little redundant, some kind of a servant. The Shachbah v'chekecha, I think that should be obvious, sleep with the king. The Chamla Adonai HaMelech, and she'll warm him up. She'll bring him from whatever disease he had. Vayivakshu na'arad yafa v'chol gvul Yisrael, so they found looking for a pretty girl. Vayimtsu et Abishag Shunamit. Shunem is a very famous town that we're going to come back to over and over again in Sefer Malachim. So they find this girl, Abishag. She is really good looking. She served as a sochenet. And she served him. But the king refused to sleep with her. From the biblical sense of no, he would not sleep with her. Which means she did not fulfill her obligation. And the next part, we start talking about Adoniyahu. So it's quite the segue. The first question that you might ask is, why isn't this not the book of Samuel? That is, what's the difference between the books about kings? As we have kings, we've had Saul, who's a king. We've had David, who's a king. Here we have the end of David's life, and then we have Shlomo, who's a king. Why create a separation between the book of Samuel, between Shmuel, and between Sefer Malachim?
Because the kingship was established.
What's that?
The kingship was more established.
In what way? What made the kingship more established?
Then David was basically ready to die. The whole kingship was much more established than it was when he took over from Shaul. Shaul was the first king, and then he had a battle with David,
right.
And then it took some time until the country was settling down.
That's true, although things were pretty peaceful in David's time. It's actually when David's about to die that things start to come apart a little bit. There's quite the fight for succession, which we're about to meet. That is, I'm not entirely sure that the beginning of Shlomo's life is necessarily more peaceful than David's life. If we go back to Shmuel, I don't want to take the time now, but it says that David conquered everybody around him, and he handed over a reasonably peaceful government to King Shlomo. I think that the kingdom is more established for a slightly different reason, and that's a question that you might want to ask yourself. Who was ruling before Shaul? Who was in charge of the country before Shaul?
Shmuel,
and then before that? Eli, and before that, judges. And well, let's be careful. The word shoftim, we translate as judges, but it's an unwise translation. It means leaders, rulers. Yiftach was no judge. He was a military man. There were certainly some judges who also were sitting on the Supreme Court. The only one that actually was, that we know of, interestingly enough, was Devorah. That's the only one that explicitly says she was the judges, which is kind of funny considering that, you know, today we wouldn't have neither a queen nor a judgette sitting on a court, but that's an issue for Shoftim, not really an issue for now. I'll make a statement just because I don't want to take too much time to prove it, or we won't be able to get to where I'd like to get to in the class. But the difference between a judge, a shofet, and by the way, the word shofet really comes from shevet, the bet and the fe are interchangeable, and sometimes do in fact change into an af. The difference between them is that a shofet's son doesn't rule, and a melech son rules. I could spend time proving it, but if I do so, I'd like you to, for now, take my word for it. But I could show you cases where it's absolutely true. For instance, Gidon, the famous Gidon. Gidon says, I don't want to be that. I don't want to be the king. I don't want to be the king. But in the end, 70 kids try to take over, and his son's name is Abimelech. My father was king. That's a significant statement there. And in fact, this book of Shmuel is all about people whose sons could not do the job, starting with Eli, who had Hophni and Pinchas, then Shmuel, who had, oh, I always forget his kids' names, I'm sorry, who also could not handle the job and rejected. Then Shaul, whose son probably should have been king, but lost it because his father lost it, Yonatan. Yonatan was a great king, would have been a great king, probably better than his father. And therefore, David is king, but you don't find out that he's actually registered as king until his son rules. And that's why, now, the Malbim asks a question. The Malbim, was Shaul a king or wasn't he a king?
He was made a king by Shmuel.
He was made a king by Shmuel, but in the end, since his son didn't rule, he sort of retroactively bumped from the job. I'm not saying that Shaul wasn't a king. Shaul was certainly a king. But since his son never took over,
the dynasty has not been started.
And this, if you think about it, when David tries to build the temple, he says, no, it has to be your son, and your son will build the house. And the word bayit is repeated over and over again. If you want to build a bayit, you need a bayit. But you can't have a bayit until you have a bayit.
So if the dynasty hasn't started, then the person who starts it is not really
a king. But it's kind of retroactive. Like, we give him the title, but you don't find out until the end whether he was really playing the ball game. Again, I could spend time proving this, but we'll go way over time. Right now, if you can, take my word for it. And if you're interested, at another time, I could probably go into many, many textual proofs that this is indeed the fact. And the Malbim says, well, it makes sense that David was busy fighting and he never really established the Melucha, but then he's trying to figure out what the whole thing with Abishag HaShunamit is. He says, I understand the reason why the book has to start with succession. And now, by the way, it should make sense to you all. Why does the book must start with succession? Because I got two guys fighting for succession. The kingship is not secure in any sense. In fact, there's a great risk. You can wind up with civil war, as we'll meet up later on. The houses will split. Nobody will become the king. Who knows what might happen?
Theoretically, it wouldn't have mattered because they fought amongst themselves. There were brothers or stepbrothers who were fighting. So in the end, one would have won, and that would have established the dynasty.
And that's an important point, actually, which I want to jump in right now. It's important that a book which wants to talk about kings, which means when I pass it down to my son, starts off with the first time it tried to be passed down to my son, which is this fight for succession between Adoniyahu and between Shlomo. But I have to ask you a question. Here's a question I'd like to throw your way. If you were there at the time, I know it's hard to ask questions because we're so biased, but who would you have, if it was a democracy and you could have voted for the king, Shlomo would be on the, I don't know, Democratic slot perhaps, Adoniyahu on the public side, I don't know whether that's true, or whatever. You had two slots for kings. And you went into the booth and had to pull the lever for one or the other. So who would you choose?
Adoniyahu looked like the winner.
Yeah, first of all, Adoniyahu looked like the winner. He's certainly the stronger of the two kings. King Shlomo was very young. Very young. But there's another issue also. Not only is Adoniyahu the older king, he's the oldest son of King David. And I'd like to read you a little halacha from the Rambam. Kol HaKodem, this is in the Mishnah Torah, this is the Mishnah Torah, the Laws of Kings 1:8. Kol HaKodem Benachla, anybody who inherits first, Kodem Lirushat HaMelucha, also inherits the kingship, succession. V'haben HaGadol Kodem Ben LaKatol Mimenu, the older son gets it. Now, if we go through the kings of David, yeah, since we're running a little bit slowly, if you go through it, the first king is, the first brother, the son is named Amnon, dead, deader than a doornail. Killed by Absalom for raping his half-sister, or adopted sister, in this case. So half-sister is better. Second king's name is Killah. Second boy's name is Killah, the daughter of Abigail, who came from Nabal HaKarmeli. We never know what happens to him. Chazal say many nasty things about what happens to him. He disappears from the scene. We just don't know. Third son, Absalom, dead. Fourth son, guess who? Adoniyahu. Adoniyahu is the next in line for the kingship. If you're there at the time, now why would you all, why do you have like, first of all, because we know Shlomo was, you know, Shlomo HaMelech was big Shlomo HaMelech. But why would one think that Shlomo should be the king? Shlomo was a young boy. He was born much later in Yerushalayim. What gives us the reason to think that Shlomo had any right to take the throne? who was some young punk, who was Shlomo, that he has any right to take the king. I could think of a reason why he shouldn't deserve to be the king. Because don't forget his family line. What's his family line? It was his mother. Batsheva. Don't talk about Batsheva. She's not invited to the nicest parties, you know. You see what I'm saying? Batsheva?
David promised to Batsheva that he would become...
We'll see. It's a good question. We never meet that promise in Shmuel. No such promise made in Shmuel. No such promise made in Dibrayanim. Batsheva says, yes, you made that promise to me. So we'll see whether we take her at her word. I suspect that we do.
Well,
but
who?
But even and Natan kings him, calls him up and calls him Yedidya, the loved one of king, the loved one of God. And in Sefer Divrei Hayamim, much later it says, and Shlomo will be the next one. But he was told that you're going to have a son named Shlomo, and he's going to be the next king. When he asked to build the temple, which means before any of the issues of Absalom came up. So keep in mind that's a very late, it's a late rendition. That's written by Ezra. What's the truth and not the truth? We'll never know, because Shmuel never wrote it down. Shmuel never wrote it down in the Sefer. And neither did Natan, really, although he may be writing it down here. So you got all kinds of things against you. So you're the youngest son. You got that mother, you know, that Bathsheba girl who David, you know, threw away his kingship with, that whole mess, and killed Uriah Hethi over. If you're the hoi polloi, I'm not entirely sure you'd be all that pro-Shlomo Melech. Now you're telling me that God went, even let's say God went over to him and said, I'm making a promise that the son comes out of son that comes out of David is going to be the king, that between David and Bathsheba. But who knows that? I mean, are people really aware of that? And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Natan was aware of it.
Yes, you're right.
So I'm thinking if Natan was aware of it, it must have been made known to other people as well.
How many times do people believe in prophets? In Tanakh,
I would say later prophets, not many, but early prophets had a lot of say. Not time God, people listen to these guys.
That's correct.
So he always had to kind of like weigh where it was had to be from, which is when you had a prophet or a prophet.
And we even have a case of that. David goes to Natan and says, "Should I build a Beit HaMikdash?" And Natan goes, go for it. And then Hashem comes up. It's a wrong, bad choice. Which means Natan obviously had the power. If Natan would say, Ko Amar Hashem or something like that, so I guess it was prophecy. But just because Natan said something, as Serena said, it could have easily come from the political side and even if you said it was coming from God, then people certainly could have doubted. People are no different than they are today. A prophet says something,
okay,
we have the right to believe or not to believe.
There are people that are going to question it, but there are certainly groups. These guys had followers.
I agree. He definitely had followers. I'm not trying to say he didn't have followers. I'm just trying to raise in your mind, when in our mind we know that Shlomo is the next in line. I'm just trying to raise the issue that the reason why it's taken up first thing first by Natan
is because it is controversial. There's no doubt. Look, he had followers. Adonijah had followers.
And we're gonna talk about the followers, because the other set we're gonna pair one set of followers to another set of followers. Hey, Ray, you come in, Ray.
Okay.
If you want to, it's okay.
Who is Adonijah? No.
Adonijah.
Who
is against Adonijah?
Who is his mother?
His mother was. I'll look it up. The second, it's in Shmuel.
The one from Bashan.
I'm not sure she was originally Jewish, but we'll find out. It's Sefer Shmuel Bad Per Gimel. I'll look it up and I'll tell you in a second. I even wrote it down here. It is Shmuel. Yeah, there it is. It's Gimel Pasuk Bat. No, Ben Chagit. Harvi'i Adoniyahu Ben Chagit. Actually, probably I take it back. Chagit does sound actually like a Hebrew,
yeah.
Like a Hebrew name.
Ben Chagit.
Yeah. So.
Absalom
was the son of Machai. He was the foreigner. Yeah, he was the foreigner. He's going to have the last laugh, by the way. I don't want to give away a good share, but Rechavam, you know who Rechavam's grandfather was? Rechavam will take over the kingship from Shlomo. His grandfather was Absalom. So don't think Absalom doesn't get the last laugh in the end. But we'll talk about that when we get there. It's very surprising when you find out that... What? No, Shlomo's son. He had many sons, no doubt, with 1,000 wives in the collection. You got to figure out he had a good dozen or so. But the one who took over was Rechavam, and Rechavam's grandmother, you find out, grandfather is Absalom, who was David's son, which means the king who didn't get the nod, you know, the one who had a rebellion against David and was rejected, was in the end, his line comes out to be the king, which shows you, you know, sometimes life is ironic. Now, the question still that Malbim still asks, and I don't like the Malbim's answer, but I'm not going to go into that right now. I'd like to talk about the Shunamit, but before I talk to the Shunamit, because the Shunamit story comes, and then all of a sudden we start talking about the Adoniyahu succession, which makes sense, and then we flip back into the fact that Shunamit hanging around with Bathsheba comes into the throne. So what's with the Shunamit, though? We're not just telling salacious stories here. It must have to do with the succession. So the question is, what does the Shunamit have to do with the succession? And the answer is a tremendous lot. But before we do that, I want to show you what Adoniyahu the thug does. You don't mind if I call him Adoniyahu the thug. I hope nobody takes offense. In Pasuk Hey, oh, there's his mother's name right there, actually. We could have got it right, nice and local. Vadoniyahu, is that what you were pointing at? I'm sorry. Vadoniyahu ben Chagit mitnasei lemor. He raised himself up saying, Ani emloch, I'll be the king. Vayaslo rechav ufarashim v'chamishim yish ratzim lifmanav. And he made himself a chariot and 50 people running before him. This Pasuk we've seen before. There has been another boy of David who had 50 people running in front of him, Absalom. And just in case you don't get the message, Nathan wants to make sure he does. Sometimes the Tanakh is very subtle. You have to look carefully for the message. But not here. Nothing's going to hit us over the head with it. V'lo atzavo aviv mi amole mor. His father never corrected him. We're not sure exactly about what. Madu akach asita. How come you're being the king? V'gam hu tov tor ma'od. He's a very good-looking guy, just like Absalom.
Doesn't it say that with Absalom also that his father never disciplined him? I think it does. I'll look it up.
It may, not in my recollection. Okay,
yeah,
it's possible.
That's why the parallel.
That would certainly draw it. And just in case we didn't get the parallel, Voto Yaldach Absalom. And he was born after Absalom. Now Rashi has difficulty with this. Rashi says that he was Achar. I know Rashi gives a difficult thing. I'm not going to go into Rashi right now, but the simple answer is he was the next in line for the throne, which he was, literally. If you take a look back in Shmuel, he certainly is. What Absalom is doing, imagine what Absalom is doing to David. And I want to see what kind of sickness is in David. He says, I'm going to be king. Adoniyahu says, I'm going to be king. David doesn't do anything, because if you remember the story about Absalom, do you remember the story of Absalom when Absalom dies in the end? Bini, 8, 9 times over and over. He's miserable. He's destroyed. David's life is miserable when it comes to succession.
He finds out.
That's right. And Yoav is the one who brought him back, and then when he burnt down Yoav's fields, and Yoav turned against him. But he's very upset with killing Absalom. He loves his son. He loved Absalom. And before that, he wanted Amnon to be the king, and he never corrected him about the rape issue. Never corrected him, which we'll get back to in a second also. Now I want to get back to the Shunamites. So, although think about what Adoniyahu was doing. Adoniyahu was saying, putting a big sign that said, I'm Absalom. Think about what that does to David, but I want to take you all the way back. It reminds him of David, the death of Absalom, which reminds him of the rebellion of Absalom when David was powerless, which reminds him of why Absalom got to be where in the position he was anyway, why Absalom hated David so much. David knows why Absalom hates him. Because of Amnon. And Amnon raped Tamar, who was Absalom's half-sister. But why did the whole event happen that David lost all his kids and David got chased away? It was all a prophecy. It was destined. What did David do to deserve the death by the hand of his son? What sin did David commit that he deserves the death by the hands of the revolution by the hands of his son? It should be obvious. The sin of Bathsheba. In fact, let me read it to you. It's in Shmuel Bet, if you have it, Perek Bet. Yud Aleph, and Perek Bet. Ko Amar Hashem, so says God. Now, this is not them talking in the name of God, I will tell you. Hinani Mekim Alecha Ra'am Ni Beitecha. I'm going to create evil to come up from your house. That's the prophecy. You know who's going to get you? Your own. One of your own. They'll take away your wives. And I'll give it to this guy. He'll sleep with your wives, which is exactly what Absalom did, by the way. You did in secret. I don't do things privately. I make a big show. So says God. And afterwards, all of this is a result of Bathsheba. Which means he has to look at it and say to himself, why the whole Amnon rape thing? and why the whole Adoniyahu thing. Ultimately, it was predestined. But I don't want to necessarily go with predestination. I want to go to give something else. And I can't prove it now textually from the text. But if you notice the way Amnon treats the girl Tamar, the girl he's going to rape, he uses the same words. Tamar is feeling bad, and he gives her after the rape, and then he tries to give her bread, and she cooks the bread for him. I'm sorry. Amnon pretends he's sick. And they bring in Tamar, and Tamar gives him food, lahavriato, to make him healthy. That's the same word that's used by David when David is sick after the death of his son, and the servants all come in to give him bread, lahavriato. Because he's thinking, think about it, you're Amnon, you've committed a rape, but you're also next in line to be the king. David never says anything, ever, never says anything to Amnon. And it should be obvious why. Who's David to talk? Imagine what David's thinking. You know, Amnon, we need to have a little talk about inappropriate sexual activity. Excuse me, Dad? You see what's going on? It's not only predestination. I never believe in consequence. I never believe in punishment and predestination. I believe in consequence. The sin was one of inappropriate relationships. What comes out of that is Amnon, who's willing to do what he does. He's got a good role model. And again, I want to criticize David. There are reasons why David did it, and it wasn't for sexual reasons. It was actually for political reasons. David was not some lewd guy. He wasn't some president that just goes over a hot babe whenever he sees one. I do not believe that's true. I believe it was a political action. But nonetheless, the action was certainly steeped in that kind of inappropriate behavior. And he suffers with it. His son does it, something equally inappropriate, if not more. You could argue it may not be more appropriate. They were not related, Amnon, and each one was a half-brother, half-sister. They were not directly related. What David might have done is he might have committed adultery. We could argue the point. What Amnon did was rape. It was a terrible, terrible thing, but it doesn't come up to adultery. Tamar was not, I do not believe it was an incestuous relationship, which means it's a terrible, immoral thing to do. But it doesn't come close to what David did, or at least what certainly people felt he did. And now I'd like to go back to Sefer Melachim and talk about the Avishag HaShunamit. Look at the Avishag HaShunamit. The Avishag HaShunamit is described in the following ways. He yifah, nara yifah ad ma'od. Do you know who's called the Nara? There's only one other girl who's called Nara Yafad Ma'od. And that was Bathsheba. The other one who's called the Nara Yafa was, not by the way, Abigail. Abigail was called Yishach HaChama. Yifat Toar, certainly. But another Nafa Nara is Tamar. Tamar and Bathsheba are the only two people who are referred to previously in David's life in this phase. Which means Abishag was hired, Tamar the girl was raped, and Bathsheba, the one who would mother Shlomo, were brought in to remind him of the sin with Bathsheba. Now, how do I prove that? I'll prove it. What's that? Go ahead. Do you seem a little far fetched?
Yeah.
Okay. So let me see if I can. That's true, but let me see if I could bring some Chazal and some Sukkim to prove it. First of all, who got him Abishag HaShunamit? The Abishag HaShunamit were gone by the Avadim. The Avadim were helping him out, right? Look at Pasuk 9, a verse. This is Adoniyahu's party. This is his royal party. Let's take a look at who's at his royal party. You want to guess already who's at his royal party? You see it coming, right? Vayizbach Adoniyahu Tzon of Akarim Riyim Evin Azochel Et Asher Eitlein Rogel. He sacrificed this big, you know, royal ceremony. So guess whose side the Avdei HaMelech were on? They were on Adoniyahu's side. But that's not proof enough yet. Let me bring down a little bit Chazal. Chazal say that the reason why he refused to sleep with the Shunamit, because he already had 18 wives, and he didn't want to commit a sin. Which means that by sleeping with her, he would have been committing a sin, which he refused to do. Let me bring just one more proof. And it's
he didn't say he refused, but he didn't.
That's a good point. Excellent. It says lo yida'a. So it makes it sound, people who have a more negative view would have said he couldn't, if you get my drift. He's a 70-year-old guy, he's cold, the girl comes, and he can't perform. He's impotent. But the word lo yida'a does not indicate that. Lo yochla lida'at ota would be he was unable to. Lo yida'a indicates that he had command of what was happening. I believe that's grammatically correct, but also show you that it's a point that Rashi is trying to make. Let me read you Rashi on lo yida'a, which is pasuk dalet. Rashi says like this. Lo yida'a shahabtula yafa l'chameim et abu'ula. It's very strange. That the virgin is better for warming up than a girl who has already had sex. So David here is Rashi is struggling with something. Rashi knows something for sure. That yida'a means he refused to sleep with her. And then he's got to ask a question. Why not? That was her job. If the whole thing is a health issue, then Rashi's asking a question. Why not sleep with her? Do it. It will get better, maybe. Because he recognized the word yida'a means he refused to do it. So Rashi struggled with why David was going out of his way not to sleep with her. So he comes up with this medical reason, because it's better that, because it was more important that he get warm than he actually have sex. And since warmth comes better out of a virgin girl than it does out of a girl who's been around the block, so therefore he wants to keep her as a virgin. Okay, that's Rashi. It's not. I don't like Rashi's answer, but Rashi is definitely onto something, because that's Malvin's answer.
Says that's
But I want to show you what Chazal say. Rabbeinu Tenu Amru Mishum Shalo Yar Ben Nashim. It was a conscious decision because he didn't want to have more kids than necessary. And now I want to show you another Chazal, which is, you know, almost beyond PG-17, but it's an unbelievable Chazal. So let's jump ahead. I'm going to jump ahead in the narrative a little bit to where Bathsheba comes in and David finally accepts Bathsheba. So let's go to verse 20.
But why would sleeping constitute having a wife?
We'll see. Just a second. We'll see. Oh, you're right. The whole medrash can't be taken literally, because he's allowed to have as many pilugshim as he wants. There's a limit on wives, but not on pilugshim. Absolutely right. So therefore, the whole medrash can only be understood, in my opinion, in what's behind the message. But I'd like to read this other medrash. It's unbelievable. It's a shocker that Radak brings down. There's a pasuk chaf chet, and it says like this. Vayana Melech. This is where David actually wakes up and he agrees that Shlomo is supposed to be the king. And even though Bathsheba is standing there, because Bathsheba was the first one, first Bathsheba comes in. I'll go through the text shortly. And then David, and then Nathan comes in. They convince David he's supposed to get up off his seat. He's supposed to say, Shlomo, I didn't make a promise. Shlomo's going to be the man. And he does. And he gets up and he does just that. And he goes like this. Vayana Melech David Vayomar. This is in verse 28. Vatiru li Bathsheba. Call me Bathsheba. Now this is clearly a political statement, because Bathsheba was in the room. Now, she was standing there. In fact, Rashi jumps on it. He says, Kiruli the Bathsheba. Was it Rashi? Almost all the Mepharshim do. In Radak, I'll read you Radak. Kiruli the Bathsheba. Lo yatsa me'acheder. Obviously, she hadn't gone out of the room. This is all happening at the same time. Aval rachkami meno. She walked far away. So he had to say, call to Bathsheba. But I think what's going on here is a succession. It's a political statement. I want you to call Bathsheba, and I'll show you the political statement that's about to be made. That Chazal see, and they hide it in a medrash that you're tempted to throw away as being ridiculous. And the Radak does throw it away, to his, in my opinion, to his mistake. Kiruli the Bathsheba tavol lefnei amelech, let her come before the king, v'tavol lefnei amelech, v'tamol lefnei amelech, and let her stand before the king. Now this is textually difficult. Why is it textually? By itself, they make a big deal about, what does it mean, come before the king and stand before the king? She's already standing. Now, by itself, sometimes the Torah likes to get flowery, the Navi certainly likes to get flowery language. There's no reason to make a big deal about it, except in the next pasuk, what does it say? Sorry, not the next pasuk. In pasuk Lamed Bet, 32, he's calling support from, he wants to make it official, so he calls the prophet and the priest, Sadok and Natan. Vayomer HaMelech David Kiruli, I'm sorry, yes, with Sadok are calling the Natan and Navi, and Natan's certainly standing there. Ulevanahu ben Yehoyada, he's the head of the armed forces, or will be. Vayavol lefnei HaMelech, and they came before the king. Never says they came and stood up, says they came, and that's the normal. So if I would have had Kiru, they should come before the king and stand before the king by themselves, or both cases, no big deal. But if the other guys are called, and they're in the room too, at least Natan's in the room, and they only come, but Bathsheba comes and stands up, there's clearly something being hinted at by the text that's not so clear. So I'll show you, I'll tell you what Chazal say, and then you can either buy what I think what it's clear that Chazal mean and what I believe to be true, or you could say it's not supported. Certainly either way, but I see that all works together. Let me read you Radak. It's unbelievable. It shows you the beauty of Chazal and how you have to be very careful before taking them literally. But because the worst thing is, if you take them literally, you'll think their words are gross. You won't understand not understand what they're trying to say, but you'll think they're idiots. They're flat out idiots who couldn't read a pasuk. Kiruli the Bathsheba. I'll read you the Radak here. V'hadrash katuv bazer rachok ma'od. This drash is written by here. It's way out there. Rachok Mo'od means I just don't see it working out. What it, but he says it. Shenemar, because he's really saying it to knock it down, but thank God he said it, because otherwise it might have been lost. Shenemar, ki l'tashmish kara. He called her for sex. Lahodia la'avishag, to tell Avishag, ki ma shelo yida'a, that which I refuse to have sex with you, Avishag, l'saba shahayita asuralo, Shayita asuralo, because you, I cannot have, because you're asur. Lo mipnei shelo haya yachol. It's not because I couldn't manage. Thank you very much. Now, he stops the medrash there, but the end of the medrash should be obvious. He's making a point. He needs to have... Now, if you misunderstand this, and I believe it's possible to misunderstand, this is all an ego thing. David wants to prove that he's a man. That's not what's going on here. He's proving that sex with the Avishag is Aser, but sex with Batsheva is Mutter. You see? That's the statement. I didn't do it with you because I didn't want to. Her, I want to.
But why is it technically Mutter
or Aser? The technicality, it's Aser because he has theoretically 18 wives and he can't have another wife.
But
I don't think that's what's going on here. The Shunamit is supposed to represent... What's that?
He could have as many wives as he wants.
You know, 18 wives is the max, according to Chazal. Pilag Shot, however, he's allowed to have more.
Right, so
there's no... Yeah, the Isser here can't be... Chazal would point at a technical Isser just to point out that the Avishag represented Isser. And that's what they say here. And how does he prove that she represents Isser? Because I have to prove that I could have done it, and I'm going to do it with her right in front of you. You see? That's the mashma. No. That's why the Radak rejects it. The Shunamit is standing there. How do I know the Shunamit is standing there? Take a look at where is she? She's standing right there.
Well, what difference does it make if she knows or doesn't?
Right.
Because it's symbolic. Natan is not writing a history for the sake of writing a history. And by the way, he didn't have sex with her on the floor. No way. That didn't happen. Why are Chazal trying to say that it was done in front of Avishag? Because if Avishag is a representation of what is not good, if he's there to remind David, you're a sinner. You know what? And everybody knows what David's sin is. And everybody knows the produce of David's son. And in fact, the first produce of David's sin died. God said, this child is us or can't live. Afterwards, David took Bathsheba and was Menachem there and then had a baby. The baby was called Yedidya. But you think everybody accepted that? It was that Bathsheba girl. And the Avadim supported the revolution. There's another proof I don't want to go into. We'll run out of time. I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
Were you going to... One of your other questions, because this woman, the Shunamit, was also when she was like a spy. I think that... Remember, you did a class on the conversation where she was standing there, and it was definitely her.
I don't remember saying it. Was it good?
Yeah.
I wish I recorded back then. Yeah. Well, she's standing for all of this. The whole conversation with Natan and No. This is only here. But I guess...
We did this in another class, and we were talking about how her role... We weren't talking about herself, we were talking about what her role was, and she was actually
a spy. Yeah, it certainly looks that way. She was certainly hired by the enemy, which is the Avadim, who we find out are on the wrong side. By the way, I can tell you during the Avshalom, we'll definitely run out of time if we try to do it now, but if you look up in Sefer Shmuel, in Perek Zion, I think, when Avshalom comes busting through, Dub is like, let's get out of it. He turns to his Avadim, he says, let's get out of the city. And they don't budge. It's like, come on, we need to get out of the city, or we're all dead, don't you understand? He'll kill you too. And then they leave the city. These Avadim, to be honest, you have to say they're bureaucrats. They like their job. And you go with the most powerful guy, and the most powerful guy at that time was Avshalom, who looked like a winning bet. And the most powerful guy now is Adoniel, who looks just like Absalom, of course, and that's the whole setup. The Shunamit is certainly hired by them. And if you take a look back in the whole conversation of Bathsheba in Pasuk Tedvav, Batavo Bathsheba or Melech HaChadra. So Bathsheba comes in, Vamelech Zakein Ma'od, Vavishaga Shunamit, Mesharet Ed HaMelech. And the Avishag is standing right there during this whole conversation. She's certainly privy to the whole conversation. But what's more important is, what is Natan trying to tell us? Who cares whether the Avishag is here? If the Avishag was all about the fact that David couldn't manage and he was a sick old dude and let's just put him out to pasture, then that's fine for the beginning. But what does that have to do with the fact that it's right in the middle of this whole plan by right when Bathsheba's walking in, she turns around and she goes, and look who's standing there. It's Bathsheba on one side saying, listen, you promised me that my son would be the next king. And the Shunammite, who represents his sin, and if he refused to have sex with her, it could have only been because she represented something that he did not want to have a part of. And he accepted her for everything else. She was supposed to serve him and warm him and sleep with him. And it says, and she served him, and he warned her, but David refused to sleep with him. That's an attestation, that attests that David's fighting against this. David doesn't know what to do. He's caught between a rock and a hard place. And then you have this massive confrontation between Shunammite, who represents everything that's wrong and immoral in kingship and sexuality that goes along with it, and Avishah and Bathsheba, who represents what's good in it, except David remembers those days, and he knows that people think that Bathsheba is not so good. We have about 7 minutes left, and I want to talk about the plan. There's a few more things to talk about, so next week, God willing, we'll wrap up a few loose ends. But I want you to show you the beautiful, in order to understand Natan and Bathsheba's role, we need to read through the Pesukim about this whole plot that Natan hatched to get power back into Shlomo's hands. First of all, by the way, Adoniah calls a party where he says, I'm going to rule, but we'll find out that he's actually already grabbed the kingship. And he doesn't invite Shlomo and her mother, which seems to me to say that they knew about Shlomo's prophecy to be the king. Because if he was just another punk,
right. Yeah.
You might as well invite him also. All the other brothers are on, the whole army's on.
Well, no,
they must have been. Whether it was well accepted, that I would say. But certainly people knew about it and accepted that it was certainly said. Let's take a look at what goes on. So Natan says, listen, we're in big trouble. So he goes over to Bathsheba and says, here's the plan. So this is in Pasuk Yud. No, Yud is where he's not called. Natan's not called, the Giborim are not called, Shlomo's not called, Pasuk Yud-Aleph, verse 11. Vayomer Natan al Bathsheba, aim Shlomo lemor. And by the way, Bathsheba aim Shlomo lemor is indicative. I mean, they're trying to make a connection between her and her relationship in Shlomo. Halo Shama'at. By the way, from a grammar sense, in modern Hebrew, we never say that, right? Look at the word Shama'at. It has a patach under the ayin. Do you see that? That's correct. We don't say the word. When you say to somebody, did you hear in modern Hebrew, it's Shama'at. Or better yet, katavt. But it's not like that, actually. For instance, if you put on tefillin, so you know, it's v'erestich l'Hashem, v'yadat et Hashem. In modern Hebrew, it's not v'yadat with two patavs, it's just v'yadat with a patav and a shva. Modern Hebrew is like that, but actually in ancient Hebrew, just get curious to look, for a grammar sense, this is how it's spelled when there's a guttural letter in the third place. So with the ayin, it's shama'at and not shamat. It's just a side point. Now here's something interesting. What does he say to Bathsheba? David doesn't know. The implication is David doesn't know, not that Adoniah wants to be the king, but Adoniah has already done the deed. Give you a piece of advice. Malti nafsheich is very clear what it means. Your soul will be saved. The implication is that if he takes the kingship, guess who's going to die? Now, Rashi doesn't go with it. Everything okay there? Rashi doesn't go with this. Rashi says that they're going to be kicked out or whatever it is. But that's not the real politics that we know of. When somebody takes over, you're off the person who gave you a challenge. That's simply the way things go.
If Natan hadn't intervened, things would have taken a different turn.
Much different. Natan would have probably been dead also. Natan, the whole bunch of them would have been dead. I want you to go to the king. This is where he said, I want you to remind him that he promised you. And I assume that this is not a lie. I assume that there really was a promise, which he is simply either forgotten or ignored. And he, as in Shlomo, will sit on my seat. That's the promise from David. So how come Adoniah is the king? And while you're still talking about Melech, I will fill your words. The implication is that they're going to tell the same story. In fact, the uncle, it's not uncle, it's Targum pseudo Jonathan, Targum Yonatan, who's not really Yonatan, but that's neither here nor there, says, I will prove that your words are correct. The implication is the promise that you made to her, I will repeat the promise. But that's not what happens. Let's read carefully what happens. So Avishag is there when Bathsheba comes in. Almost Pasuk Zion. What do you want? You promised that Shlomo would be the king, my son. Who's sitting on my throne? Adoniyahu is the king. You didn't know what happened. Which means she's not accusing him of foul play. What is she accusing him of?
Not knowing.
Ignorance. He didn't do anything wrong. Then she tells about the party, which we'll get back to in a second. So the theory is Nathan's going to say the same thing. That's what he said he'd say. But Nathan is a smart, smart guy. Look what Nathan says. Skip over to Pasuk Chabad. Hinei odena medaberet b'melech. She's still talking to the king, which proves that she's still in the room. V'natan anavi ba. Nathan comes. V'yagidu l'melech le'mor. Hinei natan anavi. V'yavol l'fnei ha'melech. V'yishtach l'melech al pav arza. Falls on the floor. V'yomer natan adoni ha'melech atah marta adoni ha'yimloch acharai. V'hu yoshev al kisei. Now, is that a question or a statement? Ata amarta, my lord the king, you said, Adoniyahu yimloch, Adoniyahu will be the king, acharai, after me, v'hu yeshev al kisei, and he will sit on my throne.
It's a question.
That's exactly what Rashi understands. Rashi says, bitmiya. Now watch what happens. Ki arad hayom v'yizbach shorim riv etzom merov, he tells him about the whole party again. And they didn't call me in Shlomo, again. Now, Patsachet Zion is the beautiful one. If it's true that the king said this, and you didn't tell your servant, who would be on the throne after you, then what? There's a missing pasuk here. Let's think about it in English. If it's true that you appointed, indeed, that you're the one who appointed Adoniyahu, and you didn't tell your servant, that's me, yes. Where's the rest of the pasuk? You follow? Well, which means you have to read this a little differently, and I'm going to read a little differently. If it's true that you gave this word, and you didn't tell me who's going to be on the throne, which tells you something very important about Natan, which we should have known anyway. Who's the one who gave Shlomo the name Yedidya? Natan. Who's the one who told David that he can't be the king and Shlomo's going to be the king and he'll build the Mikdash? That's Natan. Natan is responsible for all things involving succession.
First he sends Bathsheba, then he's Abazah.
Oh, but beautiful, but it's a totally different message. He accuses him of knowing about it but refusing to take Natan's word for it. You follow? Bathsheba's going to play dumb. David doesn't know. And maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. They're not far away. They're at the Gihon. Gihon is very close by. From Bathsheba, he's not going to tell Bathsheba to go accuse him of not being aware. He's going to tell Bathsheba, I'm sorry, of being a bad king. He's going to say, you just didn't keep my promise. You didn't, I understand, David, you told my husband, you didn't know, but you made this promise. Don't forget the promise, you got to come through. That's not what Nathan says. Oh, Nathan says, who gave you, who died and made you king, so to speak?
So it's the purpose really to shake him up.
Oh, absolutely. But shake him up with two different messages. How dare you do this thing? And now I want to show you that's in Bathsheba's message also. And I want to show you this beautiful poetry in Bathsheba's message. If we go to Bathsheba's message, Pasuk Yud Chet, and also Yud Aleph. Let's start with the plot, where the plot starts. Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11. Vayomer Natano Bathsheba Eim Shlomo Limor. Halo Shamat, did you not hear? Ki Malach Adoniyahu Ben Chagit. Va'adonenu David lo yada. There's a play on words here. What's the play on words? There are two words which are very similar. Adoniyahu, the name of the king, and Adonenu, our king David. Now here it's not so obvious, but take a look at what she says to him in, I have to really close up now. Vata, take a look at Pasuk Yuchet. Vata hine Adoniyahu malach. Adoniyahu has taken a kingship. Vata Adoni hamelech. Lo yadata. Do you see the play on words? Adoniyahu malach, ata adoni hamelech, which means he's not supposed to be the king. You're supposed to be the king. Because David certainly knew what was going on. It was apathy that was driving David. It was tiredness. It was sense of fear and sense of sin that was driving David. David knew. How do we know that David knows? Because Nathan accuses him of knowing. Bathsheba's not going to say it to his face, but the hidden message in Bathsheba is, you're the king. And I'm going to finish with just with two ideas. The first one being that what she says, the reason why they mention the only thing that's shared between the two things is the party. And the key thing about the party is that Shlomo's not invited, which means Shlomo's going to be killed. and there are other bad things that are going to happen also. All about sacrifices. Adonai Yahweh is making the sacrifices, and that's what the Rambam says. The Rambam says there's only one condition that the older son doesn't get it, and that's if he's not a Yirei Shemayim. If he's not a Yirei Shemayim, you go down the list. And that makes the break, which means in order to prove that Adonai Yahweh does not deserve to be the king, you've got to prove that he's a terrible guy, which she does, but again, I'll go too long. And there's another thing which happens here, which is surprising. David is alive. We read in the book of Chronicles, David's alive and lives for a good long time, so it's not a physical disease. It was a disease of apathy. But I want you to know what Bathsheba has told him to do. I want you to put Shlomo on the king while you're still alive. And you might think that that's obvious, but it was rare in the ancient Near East. In Egypt, it was almost unheard of for a very simple reason. The king was God. You can't have two gods at the same time. You had maybe, you can count the number of kings that established their son in their own time on the palm of your hand, or less, maybe two, maybe three. In Mesopotamia, it was more heard of because some of them were gods and some of them were remote, but it was still very rare because the king never wants to give it up. You hear about it all the time, even within Judaism, that people just can't give it over to the next person. What's that?
Right.
People just can't. Why don't people just say the next person takes it? It goes against normal grain. That's the chachma that's happening here. Now, it's not the first time it's happened, but the general policy is kings don't give it up until they're dead. And Bathsheba says, if you do that, we have a nightmare. You can't live that way. And that was a great chachma that she invented, and unfortunately, Shlomo would not follow through on that. We'll just tie up the end part where the actual party takes
Shlomo
place. Shlomo did not appoint a king in his time, as far as we know. And he left
and
it up for succession.
And Yerevan started
And Rechavam comes up, and we're not sure Rechavam was really one to be chosen. It's a good question. Many of them didn't. A few of them did. We'll see a few of the best, the better ones did, usually. The worst ones didn't want to give it up. But we'll go through it, and we'll see which ones. Next time, we'll finish off the party. We'll show you the comings and goings, and then we'll move on to chapter 2. I'm sorry I went a few minutes over time. Have a good night.